I'd like to acknowledge Australia's First Nation people as the traditional custodians of the land, and for this episode in particular, the Wurundjeri Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
My love affair of Riesling is really strong. It's it definitely my favourite white variety, but for so many reasons. I love growing it, making it, love drinking it, tasting it.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shantae Whale.
Jacob Steen is chief winemaker at Robert Steen Winery in Mudgee. He stands as the third generation of one of Australia's pioneering winemaking families. He joins me today to shed light on the iconic estate. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Shantae. Thanks very much for having me on today.
It's been a long time coming. I'm thrilled that you can join me, and I can't believe it. We've scheduled it so close to harvest. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. And a few weeks ago when we scheduled it, I didn't think we were going to be crushing, but we're already our second week in, and there's grapes everywhere at the moment. So it's actually good for me to have a little bit of time away from the winery and just get out and look at the bigger picture for a while with you. So yeah, I'm excited.
Well, you're being very kind, but I'm sure you're highly stressed. I have found that this vintage is all over the place in all different regions of Australia. So every, you know, podcast scheduling that I thought would be okay is at a weird time. So I really appreciate you persisting with it. Tell me a little bit about your first memory of wine. It must go back quite a ways.
Yeah, it does. Obviously, because I am the third generation, it was when I was quite young. We always had wine around the house, even though it was quite different back then. Most of the times back then it was our own wine or trials. Where I did live down in Sydney, so but when we came up to Mudgee on school holidays, long weekends, all the times to work in the cellar door and then in the winery and vineyard. So I was immersed in it from when I was fairly young, but I suppose it's quite different to what we have here today. So it was quite fond memories riding through the vineyards on the motorbikes and having a good time with my brother and sister and cousins as well.
Yeah, that outdoor lifestyle has got to be pretty nice. Tell me a little bit about how the Robert Steen Winery came into being, you know, originally going back those multi-generations. Give me a brief rundown. I know it's a lot to pack into one question.
Yeah, that's it. Now, we do have a rich history, like you mentioned, but in the 1970s, my grandparents found a nice block of 50 acres of land about 8 kilometres north of Mudgee. So in 1976, they started planting the vineyard, and it was really their retirement plan, and the whole family loved, you know, having the farm up in Mudgee, and it's really just kept growing ever since. My parents and then Dad took it over when my grandparents eventually really did try to retire and eventually passed away. But then Dad, luckily for all of us, kept it going. And then it's really just kept growing bit by bit over those years. And now we're up to 48 years old. And really over the last 15 years, I suppose, of me being back, we've really tried to grow it, but in the right direction. And we've sort of taken it from more of a hobby farm, vineyard, small winery up to a bit more of a serious sort of production with a focus on quality. So it's a lot to pack in there in that 48 years, but it's been fun.
Well, you've certainly done that. You know, your winery is probably one of the most prestigious wineries, and quality is certainly at the topmost of your production. You've had a huge amount to do with that. I know you're a humble guy, but you have. Tell me a little bit about what kind of viticulture was like when your family kind of moved into that area and how you've seen it change over time.
Yeah, it has. I still remember back in the early days, you know, things were done a fair bit differently. And when you're trying to establish a vineyard, that we didn't have the infrastructure anywhere near like we do today. Even in the first few years of establishing the vineyard, we didn't have water. So my grandparents and parents had to water them by hand on weekends. And now, you know, we've got irrigated watering throughout the whole of the property. So it's quite different. And even though we might say it's a lot easier to do things these days, we've got a lot of different challenges. But I really took on the regenerative approach. And I think, you know, as an industry, we definitely have to all go down that path and do our best for the environment. But we've really taken that approach across the whole business. And it starts with our vineyard. We do anything necessary to really try and improve the soil and the land in which we farm. So using that regenerative approach by limiting our inputs, implementing cover crops and using compost and grape mark from the winery, and really having a soft and gentle approach. So we look after our soil and our vines, and we've seen a massive increase in improvement and quality over those last 15 years just through doing a lot of basic work. Like some of those things I've mentioned has really helped lift our organic matter up from around 1 to 2% when I arrived up to 5 or 6%. And I know that looks like it's only a small jump, but I think it's a massive turn towards just showing how much organic matter and soil improvement there is underneath the vines. And I think we'll keep trying to improve many other ways as we move forward.
It's so important and incredible to see the work that you have done. But I mean, you're not just interested in grapes. You do have a bit of a farm out there too. You have a bit of livestock, is that right?
Yeah, we do. So it is quite diverse, and it all integrates really well, and that's what I love. I do love the farming side of it. We've got livestock, cattle, sheep, and even free-range pigs. And that's a nice little side venture for us, even though that itself is sort of slowly growing as well. But it gets me out of the winery a bit and into the farm and the vineyard a fair bit more. So our livestock integrates really well. We even put the sheep and sometimes the pigs into the vineyard in winter. Eventually those livestock feed the restaurant and the cellar door as well. So it's really trying to become a self-sufficient, property. And whilst we still, even our own veggie garden, trying to grow as much as we can to use on our own farm. So it is quite diverse, and we love that. Sometimes it does get really busy, like at vintage time when you're trying to do vintage and harvest as well as look after the farm and animals. But like I mentioned, it's a nice little sideline that I can get out to and just sort of take a breath during really busy harvest time. But it's really fun. It's really rewarding to grow livestock on our own farm. And the free-range pigs, we've only really had, well, it's close to 10 years now, but that keeps growing, and we're finding ways of integrating them into, we've got a salami brand now as well, Steen Farm Produce, which goes really well in the Mudgee region, and we're quite sort of proud that we're only one of a limited few pork producers in the region and even the greater Central West. But we sort of love doing it, and get our boys involved in something fun for them as well to get out there and feed the pigs on weekends and make sure they're doing well. So it's everyone can get involved in that part, and it's really fun to have so much happening out there at any one time.
I think it's always been clear that you've had a very holistic approach, and I think that that's important. But there is so much talk these days about what the right path is for looking at sustainability. Do you find that's challenging, telling the story about, biodiversity and some people going down the organic route, some people going down biodynamic. Do you find that that's a challenge when you go to sell your wines?
Yeah, it's definitely, it's becoming increasingly, well, consumers are becoming increasingly aware of all the jargon and ins and outs of organics and biodynamics, but they're mostly interested in what we're doing to look after our land and the product, I think. So we're definitely going in the right direction. We've, as I mentioned before, implementing all of these better procedures and principles and actions by reducing our inputs with very limited use of chemicals. We're trying to alternate with just tilling, and we do have one certified organic block which luckily enough has been certified since 1990, so we lease that block. That gives us a fully organic block, which then we convert into certified organic wines because our winery is certified organic as well. So we do have that market, and we only make the two wines, and they've grown exponentially. It's nice to have those wines, but then it's also really nice to say that our whole farm is holistic and regenerative, and we look after our land, and we can really see the outcome when we discuss this in the cellar door. And I think that's what matters most to our consumers. And even having single vineyard wines off our own vineyard in the front of the cellar door, they can really see, the pathway. It's so close. It's not, nothing against the big wineries at all, but it's so different and so unique when you can show single vineyard wines and how they're handcrafted, they're handpicked straight into the winery, they're crushed in the tank within an hour or two, and then they form their whole process into the bottle, which we then sell mostly at the cellar door. And I just think overall that's such a holistic approach as well, because it's reducing a lot of inputs like other external factors like transport and all those external things that happen with some larger producers as well. But it's becoming such a big aspect of people inquiring in our cellar door. And I'm glad that we're on the front foot and really trying to look after our land and think about the future. And that's probably what's most important, because if we are going to be there and be in a better shape for the next generation, then it needs to start now. And we've got to really, I suppose, track our progress. And I think we're doing a good job to move towards a better future.
Very much so. I think being on the front foot is a good expression, I think, for you guys. What I love about your business is that you really manage to capture a history and a presence of what Mudgee has been and what Mudgee will be. And I think that that's really well expressed in your offerings of wines. There is, a distinct range of wines, but it takes you through almost a journey of kind of what was important to Mudgee a long time ago. Where are the historical roots? What are we looking at now? What are we playing around with the future? And your whole range of wines takes you through that journey. I would like to know a little bit about the important varieties, the historical important varieties, and then talk a little bit about kind of what you're playing with and where do you think will be Mudgee's strength down the track?
Yeah, great. It's a really important question, I think, because that's what makes Mudgee so unique, in that we've got currently a nice band of young winemakers, like myself. I can still say that because I'm in my 30s. But There's plenty of us as friends. We all get along really well. And we talk about these things all the time. So historically, Mudgee's been known for those richer, earthier reds. And whilst the good thing is, I think it's still great that there's still some producers around that are still holding on to that. And I think that's important that there's still that option and glimpses of the past. But what we're seeing more of is the new generation coming through with more exciting styles. Many different varieties have been planted over the last few years. We've been included in that, but I think nearly every producer is looking towards other producers and alternative or more suited varieties to Mudgee if it is going to keep getting warmer. So we've really got a good, eye on our past, but also trying to ensure that we stay relevant. And even the styles of Shiraz that we produced, even back in 2009, it was a great vintage, but they're quite largely framed wines. They do have a bit of earthiness and thickness about them, but then some of the wines that we've made here in the great vintages of the last 5 to 10 years just so much more modern. They're fruit driven, but they've still got enough complexity to help give them enough age worthiness, which people often still ask for in the cellar door and when buying wine. It's good. I mean, a lot of Italian varieties have been replanted here. We've got some of the oldest sites and the first plantings of many Italian varieties, but they unfortunately got pulled out through a lot of mismanagement over many years. But it's good to see that they're coming back in. But where they are going back in is probably some of the better sites for those alternatives and the Italians. So really excited about the future. Our Montepulciano has such a great potential. I don't think it'll ever come on and maybe take on our Riesling as our flagship, but I'm excited that we've got that opportunity to do something very different with an Italian red like Monty that we love making, love growing. The last few years it's been through drought, heaps of rain, and then a cool vintage, a warm vintage, and it's done really well every single year. So I think we've got to keep searching for those type of varieties that we can, rely on to do really well and consistently every year. And it doesn't really matter as much if we have a wet vintage or it's too dry, and we don't need to, we don't need to intervene. If it is going to be too wet, we can just know that the Monty's going to do its thing. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited about that variety, and we've done well in shows. But apart from that, it's just a great drink, and it suits Mudgee because of our climate and our soil. And the great thing is that Mudgee as a whole is doing that. Everyone has put in similar varieties that they really love. There's 3 or 4 other Montys. There's more Sangio going in. Tempranillo has been around for a fair while, but we're just starting to understand it as a variety. And making rosés from some of these exotics is proving really good too, and they're just more balanced wines. And yeah, I'm really seeing the whole Mudgee winescape is really just lifting in quality and offering definitely something very different to what we did 50 years ago. I think I answered all of that question, but it's quite deep, and it sort of goes back so long. It's really good that there's a lot of the brands from the 70s are still around. Not all of them, but there's probably still a lot of the strong brands from the 70s are still around, like ours and Huntington and Craigmore, for example, Burnbrae as well. They're still going strong, and looking into next generations as well. So I think, yeah, I think it's great for Mudgee to really sort of start to do some things different and keep up with the times as well. But I think we're doing it really well.
Mm. I totally agree with you on that. I want to talk, I mean, when you mentioned Monty, I thought, yeah, look, it is a great variety, I think, for moving perhaps people that love and are used to some of those, like you said, those wonderful traditional varieties and those bigger, richer reds. I think Monty's a great option for trying to just introduce another darkly pigmented, quite full-bodied but higher acid kind of little bit more groovy little number. I think that Monty can do that, and it can make such a different few styles of wines. Like you said, it makes great rosé, it makes a really crunchy chilled red, it can make quite a big style as well. So I agree with you. I think Monty's a really good option for probably also just for the region and for moving people in a different direction, but at the same time, you know, not going too fast and you know, giving them some kind of Cab Mac strange looking crazy red that they're never going to enjoy. But I want to talk about Riesling, because you make some stunning Rieslings and you have a bit of an affinity for them. Tell me about your love affair with Riesling.
Yeah, well, my love affair of Riesling is really strong. It's definitely my favorite white variety, but for so many reasons. I love growing it, making it, love drinking it, tasting it. It really started, and even though we've got a long history with Riesling in Australia, our family goes back to being the first to bring it to Australia in 1838 with Johann Steen and the MacArthur family planting Riesling down in the Camden vineyards and eventually establishing those vineyards in southwest Sydney. So whilst we've got a really long history with it, the German heritage is also quite strong. So I've been back there for numerous vintages and also just trips to go around and taste it, taste all the wines from many different regions, especially from the Rheingau. And Rheingau and Rheinhessen, even though they're maybe not quite as known or iconic as maybe some of the Mosel, I think the future is really strong. In 2006, I did a vintage in Rheinhessen and then went over to the Rheingau, but really loved. I worked at Weingut Whitman, and he was one of the back then maybe rising stars, and just loved his affinity for Riesling and saw how much time he spent in the vineyards, and he always really discussed how important and how much work Riesling takes in the vineyard to make sure it's happy and sound. And then, you know, all of the work in the winery was so much easier when the grapes were in perfect condition. So I've had long enough for me to understand a bit about Riesling. And I'm really lucky that we've got old vines in our site. So they were some of the first planted, being 1976. And a lot of them were replanted over the late 70s and even into the early 80s, because it's such a tough, hard site. So red ironstone, there's quartz and shale. There's not too much soil in there. It's a bit of hard rock right up the top of the block. And that's why we make our reserve wines from that particular area, just because it shows the strength and concentration of that site. But yeah, I love making Riesling for so many different reasons, and of course it's because of our family history. But I think it's going to take me probably forever to understand exactly why we make really good Riesling. It often just sort of stumps me how well they do commercially and in shows. We make a few different styles, but we love our reserve and the dry. They really show our sight quite strongly, especially in the reserve being a bit of minerality, maybe with the quartz and all the hard shale and rock sort of intertwined into that wine. But we have concentrated on it as well. So I always tell, you know, all of our team out there that there's an endless budget for our Riesling vineyard. And, you know, they know how much we love it. And I think that's sort of spreading throughout our whole team as well. We really love just making and growing Riesling, and it's a real vigneron wine. You know, you need to get the vineyard right so you can make excellent wine. And it's sort of a challenge in Mudgee. It can get quite warm, but then I look at it in comparison to the Clare, where it also does really well, and we're normally three or four degrees cooler than the Clare as well. So whilst we've got the altitude, the vineyard sits at 600 meters, still much higher than the Clare. We can get a fair bit of UV, so we've got to be really careful about sun exposure and canopy management to make sure that the afternoon sun is the fruit shaded in the afternoon. So moving canopy, growing it in the right direction, so we make sure we do that naturally. And then if they are getting a bit exposed, the great thing is that there's natural products like kale and sunscreen to be able to just help shield them and do things naturally, so we get, you know, pristine Riesling juice. And yeah, I think it has gone fairly well. I do agree. I think there's still a lot more to do, but I think we've won, the last time I counted, we've won over 70 gold medals and just over 50 trophies just for our Rieslings over the last 8 years or so. So, yeah, I suppose we should start saying that they are going pretty well.
I have heard it called the Steen Show before when it comes to a Riesling class, so.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, sometimes it can be.
Well, you know, that's a wonderful problem to have. And you have, like you said, you do have some amazing releases of Riesling. You're also, you know, looking at a little bit of barrel fermentation with your Blue Hen Riesling as well. But I'd like to know, and that's such a fun wine, I'd like to know a little bit about your thoughts on sugar. And we are seeing a real kind of renaissance happen, I think, in Australia with Riesling, of everybody kind of accepting a little bit more about sugar and its place within Riesling and at whether it suits the site. But I agree with you. I feel like there's not a lot of places to hide if the grapes aren't in the right spot in the vineyard. And I think, you know, if that vineyard's not looked after, and if you haven't done the work there, there's a barrel ferment, too much sugar, added acid, whatever it is, it really shows, like, elbows and knees, I think, in Riesling. It just pokes out and it just – so, yeah, like, I agree. What are your thoughts on sugar and its place?
Yeah, it's one of the major decisions when fermentation is finishing with Riesling, and that is to when to stop it. And like you say, there's a lot of, you know, purity and reservation and nowhere to hide in a Riesling, so you can't make any mistakes at all. But yeah, sugar's really important, but it really depends on acidity and acid balance. So we retain really nice acidity in Mudgee and New South Wales as a whole, really, because we are generally cooler or on the cooler side. So it's really nice having nice acid retention. So pHs are quite low. TAs can be high. So it's nice to be able to fit in a little bit of residual sugar. So whilst our reserve might only have 1 to 3 grams, The dry between 2 to 4 or even 5 still looks pretty good and still looks dry, but that sugar just gives it a little bit of volume and makes sure that it's really drinkable on release after a year. So, yeah, it's a massive, it's definitely one of the big decisions that we make. And of course, then we've also got a half dry, and like you said, a lot more just off dry Rieslings are popping up, and so they should. It's good to see how many more there are, because it's just so much easier to drink with spicy food, and sometimes they're more approachable when they're young. However, the acidity and sugar level really helps, I think, those wines age for a long time, which is one of the other great things about Riesling, and that, you know, the well-made ones can last for many, many years. And, yeah, well, I know some of our 09s, which was my first vintage, are drinking exceptionally well at the moment. And I just remember how, just the acid and sugar balance we got back then was spot on, luckily, and I think it's showing in the wine, 15 years later, just that we nailed that balance, and it's just kept the wine balance its whole life, and, brought on different characteristics. So the age worthiness, I think, is really important and got to do a lot with that. Acid and sugar balance. So, yeah, it's definitely one of the most important things with Riesling, and I suppose all varieties, but in Riesling there's not too much place to hide, similar to Semillon.
Absolutely. I think that it's just, like you said, it's so great to see lots of different styles, lots of people drinking Riesling. It's a drink that you can have any time of the day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, in between. And they're kind of bulletproof, I find, in the fridge. I don't know what it is about Riesling. And maybe it is that bit of sugar, but I just find that it's a bottle I can open and still 5-6 days later, I'm finding it still looks great, whereas that doesn't happen for a lot of other wines. And I appreciate that. My husband doesn't drink white, so I appreciate being able to keep a wine for a few days. I want to talk a little bit about your winemaker, Lisa Bray. She's won some great awards, and what does she add to your business?
Yeah, great, good question, because we work together a fair bit. And while Lisa started with us in 2016, and her role has kept growing ever since, she's now senior winemaker with us. We work together every day to try and keep improving our wines. It's a really busy winery, so two winemakers, but my role is a little bit more out of the daily activities of the winery now. So she runs the daily operations. I help her with all the large decisions. She's got a real affinity with Chardonnay and maybe Cabernet and Shiraz as well. So our strengths are, they're similar, but we sort of take on different areas. And I think the partnership that we've played here in Mudgee is really important, because we actually make nearly 50% of the wines of the Mudgee region under contract. So we do contract winemaking as well. If it was only my wines in the winery, I hope that we'd still be able to have another winemaker, but it's as a partnership, and as a company, we've done really well overall. We've won all of the winemakers of the year for the last however many years in the Mudgee region. It's either been me or Lisa and me, or Lisa on her own. So, it's been good. I mean, we do make a lot of the wines as well, so our show's success is always quite up there. But Lisa's got an attention to detail that is quite unique. She's got a great palate. We work together a lot on the bench, and I think because we see a lot of different batches, we've got a lot of great options, and we take our time to make sure every wine is as good as we can before it gets bottled. So whilst that, you know, increases the pressure a fair bit on us, we're quite excited about it, and we work together. I think we've got the best vintage team that we possibly ever have had this year. So we've got a few newbies, a couple of first-time winery workers and part of our team, but they're just really good people, and we're enjoying being able to pass on that knowledge to some newcomers as well. And we've got, you know, some of the other remaining team has been there for a long time, some of them over 10 years as well. So, yeah, it's definitely a team effort, but with Lisa steering the ship, you know, most days, I think we've done a great job, and she does a great job in all a lot of the big and little decisions. But yeah, it's definitely great having her on board. She's got her own little brand as well, LNB Wines, which is doing well, and she can have a lot of fun with those on her own. I dare not go next to those wines, but sometimes she does let me in, and we have a look at the trials and taste, you know, a lot of them and all the wines together. So it's really nice that, yeah, it's really nice that she's here and has been with us for a long time. And, yeah, I know that that's going to continue in the future, and I think she's got so much more to give and learn. And as we both sort of keep, you know, evolving in there, I think it's definitely, you know, her stance on the wines and her input has definitely been seen as well in the winery, in the Robert Steen wines, in the Blue and also the contract wines that we make. So I couldn't have definitely done the last 6 or 7 years without her in there. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. There's been some busy times too. And it's, you know, last year we had our biggest crush ever. We made over 100 wines and bottled 80 of them already last year. So, I can't believe I put that out for everyone to hear, but it's like...
That's a lot.
I know, it is. Yeah, we sort of, outside of vintage, we bottle basically every month for the rest of the year. So she sort of had 8 months without a holiday. But we've learned from that, and we're trying to change this year to make sure that that we all sort of have breaks at different times. So yeah, it's a busy little place, but she does an amazing job. And
amazing.
So well, it's great to have her on board.
You're as a collective team, are incredibly busy. I want to just wrap this up, but I want to ask you two more questions. So they'll have to be a bit rapid fire. If you're not drinking your own wines, is there somebody else in the region or another region which you kind of day in, day out buy their wines and drink them? And the second question is, if you've only got 3 drinks to drink for the rest of your life, what would they be and why?
Okay. Yeah, good. So probably from the region, I think the Huntington wines, so Tim and Nikki Stevens, they're just down the road from us. They're a bit more old school, but they're very age-worthy. And like as a young family and a team, like they've stuck to their guns and they've made some amazing wines. And their Shiraz and Cabs are more traditional mudgy, but I still love drinking them, and so does my wife Gina. So I think I get brownie points when I bring some of those bottles out. But I still haven't had a bad one; just always consistently good. And they've got a lot of history and a particular style, and it's great that they've stuck to it and just love drinking their wines. So then, if there's 3 other drinks. the first one's probably German Riesling. I think a few of those Whitman single vineyards, like the Kirchspiel, are amazing wines. Just the power and the expression of their sites. I think they're already iconic, really, for that region and probably for Germany. The other one, I don't mind Cognac, actually. I've been there numerous times, love the region and the people. And it's just, yeah, just lovely drink, and just love the region and just the stories, and going through all of the barrel tastings. It was amazing being in Cognac, and I'll sort of always remember that. The third, I've got half of my cellar are Italian wines, so it's hard to really choose one particular, but it's probably Barolo or Barbaresco. It's, you know, Nebbiolo. I just love doing a vintage there, love the culture, and I think it really shows there in their wines, that slow wine movement and slow food and slow viticulture, and just letting the terroir really express themselves in the wines. And I just, yeah, really love that that region and those wines. And it's always a special occasion when I open up, you know, something from Piemonte. So really, yeah, I couldn't do without those wines for the rest of my life. So, yeah, definitely.
Three excellent choices.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you do have, you know, you enjoy the finer things in life, and you have a very elegant palate, I have to say. I love those choices. It says a lot about you.
yeah, good.
Jacob, it's always such a pleasure when we chat. I love what you do. I think you guys are doing a fantastic job out there. I am yet to come to the cellar door, which is outrageous, but I am going to make a trip out just to see the pigs and chat to you, and hopefully we'll have a lovely glass of Riesling together.
Yeah, that'll be great. Yeah, maybe a Barolo after it as well.
Oh, you said a few outrageous things on this recording, and I'm going to hold you to it.
True, you should. I'll remind you, don't worry.
Thank you so much, Jacob. Best of luck with getting all the fruit in and making all the wines that you do. I hope we chat to you again soon sometime.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's been, yeah, nice reflecting on a lot of that stuff as well, so appreciate it.
Awesome. Cheers to you, Jacob.
Thanks. Same to you, Shante. See ya.
This is Over a Glass. I'm Shante Whale. Stay tuned for more stories from the world of wine and drinks. Listen in every Thursday on your podcast app. Follow us on Instagram at @overaglasspod and contact us at overaglass@deepintheweeds.com.au.